This as of August 26th of this year, there were about a little less than 600 cases of measles that were reported in this country. That's the biggest outbreak we've had in more than 20 years. The way that that has worked is that generally people who are susceptible to measles have traveled to countries where measles is endemic, like the Philippines, where last year there were about 32,000 cases and 41 deaths. This year, there's actually more than that. They're on pace for more than that. They then catch measles and they come back to this country, and then it spreads among a group of unimmunized children. The reason those children are unimmunized is because the parents have chosen not to immunize them. And the reason they've chosen not to immunize them is because they don't fear measles. But I fear measles because I lived through the Philadelphia measles outbreak of 1991. So, and now you're going to live through it. So it started actually on April 20th, 1989. After returning from a trip to Spain, a teenager with a blotchy rash attends an REM concert at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. A couple weeks later, several other teenagers get sick. Measles virus has now entered the city. Now, on May 21st, 1990, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. You would assume from the rather comical headline that measles is no big deal. But it was a big deal. Certainly before the vaccine was introduced in 1963, every year measles caused 3 million cases, 48,000 hospitalizations, and 500 deaths. Almost everyone was infected by 15 years of age. When children died, they typically died from pneumonia, encephalitis, or dehydration. By 1978, with an effective vaccine in place, only 27,000 cases of measles were reported. So the CDC was optimistic that they could eliminate measles from the U.S. and launch the Measles Elimination Program with a goal to eliminate measles by 1982. In 1983, only 1,500 cases were reported, but in 1989, measles came back. On June 2, 1990, this headline appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It highlighted the fact that as of May 19, 1990, there were already 35 deaths from measles reported in the United States. And for that reason, this headline in the Philadelphia Inquirer teaches us that the state urges a second measles shot for children in line with what were national recommendations. Before 1990, children received one dose of measles vaccine at around 15 months of age. But now the CDC was recommending a second dose in middle school, which gave children, for the most part, a second chance to get a first dose. This should increase the efficacy, which was excellent, by the way, for a single dose, up into the high 90% range. By November 29, 1990, 96 Philadelphia children were infected with measles. By December 7th, that number was 124. By December 31, it increased to 258. And in December 1990, also that month, an 18-month-old boy dies from measles pneumonia. That was the first measles death in our city in 20 years. On June 12, 1990, this headline appears in the Philadelphia, speaking of a second death. Both measles deaths occurred in unimmunized children. The Philadelphia Health Commissioner recommends that now a first dose of measles vaccine should be given at 6 months of age to try and stave off this growing epidemic. 7 weeks after that recommendation, city health officials will do something that has never been done before and never been done since. That's a teaser. See, that's to keep you here for the next 20 minutes. The Philadelphia commissioner at the time was Bob Ross. That's him here. He's actually in California now, working with a foundation. On January 16, 1991, Bob receives an anonymous phone call from a woman whose daughter belongs to the Faith Tabernacle Church in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia. The woman warns Ross that church members don't believe in medical care. No one had died yet, said Ross, but for the first time we worried that we might not hear about a case of measles until a church member calls the police or calls the coroner to pick up the body. The Faith Tabernacle Church's doctrine instructs members to, quote, believe that the Bible is opposed to all means of healing apart from God's way. Quote, if I go to God and ask him to heal my body, says church member Gordon Korn, I can't go to a doctor for medicine. You either trust God or you trust man. The church school contains hundreds of children from kindergarten up through the 12th grade, none of whom are immunized. This is a picture, actually, of the Faith Tabernacle Church, which still exists and is lively and vibrant. It's in North Philadelphia. For anybody who knows Philadelphia, it's right around 5th and Erie. On February 11, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. A few days before that, Karen Still, a 9-year-old girl, is pronounced dead from measles on February 10th. 3 days after that, Monica Johnson, a classmate, is also pronounced dead. Monica is one of 11 children living in the home, all of whom are unimmunized. Monica's father is a teacher at the school. Quote, I feel very confident in my belief in the way I've raised my children, he says. Monica is something that God has given us and now has taken away. After Karen Still's death, Bob Ross meets with Reverend Charles Reinert, who is the pastor of Faith Tabernacle. He was soft-spoken, the consummate gentleman, says Ross, but he drove us nuts. We told him we needed to vaccinate everyone in the school, but he said the families wouldn't let us do it. On February 12th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. So at this point, the Philadelphia court system takes the first of what is about to be 4 steps. Ross obtains a court order to visit the families who refuse to let him touch their children. He has to, all he can do, all he and his coworkers can do, is stand in the doorway and look at the child to see whether or not they need further medical care. Quote, most of the families had 6, 8, 10, 12 kids because they didn't believe in birth control, says Ross. There were also a lot of kids who were physically or mentally disabled because they all had in-house deliveries. Even if the kids were born breech, they didn't do a C-section. It was like the old days. Ross finds the children appear well, but says, quote, these kids had the rash. They were lying in bed, but they were alert, conversant, and appeared well hydrated. He pleads with the parents to let him know if their children get any sicker. On February 15th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer as another child dies. On February 14th, police were called to the home of Lynette Milnes, who was pronounced dead. Milnes doesn't attend the Faith Tabernacle School, but her sister does. Lynette's 7 brothers and sisters are all unimmunized. Quote, when another kid turned up at the morgue, I checked my list and realized she was on it, said Ross. I had just called the mother, and she told me her kids were fine. She lied to me. Ross refers the case to District Attorney Ron Castile, who considers filing criminal charges but demurs. This was actually an election year, I should point out, which did not in any small way play into his decision. Quote, unfortunately, when the parent is willing to risk the death of their children because of religious beliefs, says Castile, it's unlikely that the threat of prosecution will in any way act as a deterrent. Now the Philadelphia courts take their second step when Ross realizes that the information he's getting from parents is inaccurate. So he gets a court order to now physically examine the children. He enlists residents at our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I was there at that time, and St. Christopher's Hospital to go door to door. Quote, it was one of the more inspiring moments in my 30 years in healthcare, says Ross. These are busy people on call every third night, yet they were happy to do it. On February 15th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Daily News as 2 more children die. In the early morning of February 15th, Nancy Evans, a 5-year-old from North Central Philadelphia, dies from measles. Nancy doesn't belong to the Faith Tabernacle Church. Rather, she belongs to the First Century Gospel Church, another faith-healing group in the center of the city. Also on February 15th, Tina Louise Johnson, the 13-year-old sister of Monica Johnson, dies on the day of Monica's funeral. Neither Nancy Evans nor Tina Louise Johnson were taken to a doctor when their illnesses worsened. 5 children have now died in 10 days. You really had to be there for this. I mean, this is 1991. This is 30 years into the development of a measles vaccine, and we are suffering death after death after death in our city. We were although between 1989 and 1991, there was measles epidemics that swept across the country. No city suffered this epidemic more than ours did in this 1 month, February 1991. In the U.S., about 1 in 1,000 infected children typically were dying from measles, or would die from measles. In some developing world countries, that can reach as high as 1 in 300. But in Philadelphia, 4 of 150 children with measles who attend the Faith Tabernacle Church are dead. That is a rate of 1 in 35, worse than anywhere you would find anywhere, and any rate you would find anywhere in the world. So the CDC sends a team to investigate, headed by Bill Atkinson. The question that Bill was charged with answering was the circulating strain in Philadelphia more virulent than other strains or the strains that were circulating throughout the country? What Bill finds is that the measles deaths have nothing to do with the strain that's circulating and everything to do with the parents who are allowing their children to die because they aren't getting intravenous fluids they need for severe dehydration or supportive therapy like oxygen for their pneumonia. On February 18th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer. As finally, Charles Reiner, who was the pastor of Faith Tabernacle, had avoided the press up until this point. Now he speaks out. Quote, "The devil has tried to put fear in people's hearts," he says. "Job was robbed of everything he had. As he went through the trial, he learned from it. There is no fear when you can see God on your side." Reinert sees deaths in his church as a test of his faith, a test he has every intention of passing. "It's drawing us all together," he says. Now the Philadelphia courts take their third step, which is when Ross asks the mayor, who was Wilson Good at the time, to obtain a court order to hospitalize children who are critically ill, even though that hospitalization is against the parents' will. With a telephone number of a judge in hand, residents examined children from Faith Tabernacle Church. Quote, "It was like entering a time warp," said Mark Jaffe, who headed the St. Chris's team. "With the exception of the fact that they stay at home and watch their children die from measles, they seem like wonderful people." On February 18th, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Inquirer, as now the those who are monitoring these cases find children who need to be hospitalized. So Daniel Kern, who's a four-year-old, develops measles pneumonia. A healthcare worker insists on admitting the child to the hospital. The parents politely but firmly refuse. Ross calls city solicitor Charisse Lilly, who calls family court judge Edward Summers, who gets an emergency order to hospitalize the boy. Around the same time, a second child, one-year-old Bianca Carpina, is also hospitalized against her parents' will. Now the Philadelphia measles epidemic is at its peak. Remember, this is 1991. It's not that long ago. At CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, 82 children are seen in the emergency department and 28 have been hospitalized. At St. Chris's, 250 children have been seen in the emergency department and three are being hospitalized every week. St. Chris's is actually a little closer to these two churches than was Children's Hospital. Ross and his team have visited 80 families and 500 children, but predicts correctly that there will be more measles deaths in the city of Philadelphia. On February 21st, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Daily News. Philadelphia is now a feared destination. Two nearby schools cancel trips to the city. The city prints 50,000 educational pamphlets and is vaccinating hundreds of school children every week. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania sends $100,000 in federal funds to help. On February 27, 1991, Mayor Wilson Good asked city solicitor's office to obtain a court order to forcibly vaccinate children. This was unprecedented and remains unmatched. Now, according to the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution, states are permitted to compel vaccination of their citizens. There are two critical Supreme Court rulings that led to that. The first was the famous Jacobson v. Massachusetts ruling in 1905. Henning Jacobson was a Lutheran minister. Cambridge, Massachusetts was suffering an outbreak of smallpox. The Cambridge Board of Health required smallpox vaccination or that one pay a $5 fine. Jacobson refused both. That went initially to a local court, then a state Supreme Court, and then ultimately the United States Supreme Court, where Justice John Marshall Harlan, writing for the majority, said, quote, "The liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States does not import an absolute right to be wholly freed from restraint. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. Society based on the rule that each one is a law unto himself would soon be confronted with anarchy and disorder." This issue went to the United States Supreme Court one more time. That was 17 years later in the case of Rosalind Zucht v. King. Rosalind was a high school student who was expelled from Brackenridge High School in San Antonio, Texas, for refusing a smallpox vaccine. The difference between this case and the 1905 case was San Antonio wasn't in the midst of a smallpox epidemic. Still, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously supported the ruling that had been laid out in 1905 in Jacobson v. Massachusetts. There was one more case. It was actually a child labor case. It was in Sarah Prince versus the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Sarah Prince was a Jehovah's Witness who wanted to distribute pamphlets on the streets of Brockton, Massachusetts at night. She brought with her niece, who was only 12 years old. That actually violated child labor laws, and that actually worked its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. The judge ruling against Sarah Prince, claiming that religious freedom did not trump the local child labor laws, and had this quote, even though it wasn't a vaccine case, it's interesting that this is was said, quote, a parent cannot claim freedom from compulsory vaccination for the child any more than for himself on religious grounds. The right to practice religion freely does not include the liberty to expose the community to infectious disease. Parents may be free to become martyrs themselves, but it does not follow that they are free to make martyrs of their children. So although there is no constitutional right to refuse vaccines, states may allow exemptions. And initially, there were a number of cases shown here where parents went all the way up, for the most part, to state Supreme Courts, trying to say that my religion forbids me from getting vaccines. But in every case, they lost. Because for the most part, it was the rulings were all religions are asked to be vaccinated. Therefore, there is no discrimination based on religion. And therefore, these cases all failed. But in 1996, at the New York State Assembly in Albany, New York, a door was opened, once again showing that bad things come from New York. I'm sorry, it's the Giants, the Mets, it's all bad. So New York State was considering a bill to require polio vaccine for school entry, and it was a bill that passed by a vote of 150-2. The two dissenting votes were because the bill excluded parents whose religion forbade vaccination. Now, this is a religion that did forbid vaccination. Remember, vaccination, the first vaccine wasn't until 1796. It was Edward Jenner's polio, Edward Jenner's smallpox vaccine. So, and all the major texts of religions were written well before 1796. So we're talking about a religion that would have had to have been founded after 1796, and that was the direct result of the lobbying efforts of that particular religious group, which was? I haven't heard it yet. It's Christian Science. So founded by Mary Baker Eddy in 1875 with her publication Science and Health with a Key to Scriptures. Mary Baker Eddy believed that illness was a spiritual, not a physical disorder, that diseases could be treated with prayer, not medicines or surgeries. And she says in this book, quote, we have smallpox because others have it, but mortal mind, not matter, contains and carries the infection. So what happened then was there now was a law on the books claiming that if you were a Christian Scientist, you didn't have to get a polio vaccine in the state of New York. William Mayer took advantage of that and basically was able to successfully claim that there had been a violation of his First Amendment rights because he wasn't a Christian Scientist. He was being asked to get a vaccine, or his children were, because he wasn't a Christian Scientist. That opened the door. And from then on, state after state knocked that down so that 41 states have religious exemption to vaccination, and Pennsylvania at the time was one of them. In 1991, there already had been a law in the books in Pennsylvania for religious exemptions to vaccination. So the city now takes its fourth step, which is now we want to try and get a court order for measles vaccination. I want to make a distinction between mandatory vaccination and compulsory vaccination. In mandatory vaccination, you are asked to get a vaccine. If you don't get a vaccine, then you suffer some sort of societal price. You don't get to go to the school you want to go to, as was the case with Rosalind Zuck. You have to pay a fine, as was the case with Henning Jacobson. You don't get to work in the hospital that you want to get to, which is the case of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, if you don't get an influenza vaccine. That's mandatory vaccination. Compulsory vaccination is you are pinned down and vaccinated whether you want to be or not. And that's where we were in 1991 in the city of Philadelphia. We sought compulsory vaccination of children whose parents forbid it. Now, what Charles Reinert did was he appealed to the Pennsylvania chapter of the ACLU to represent him. I mean, to represent him really to support a law that had already been on the books. And thinking at the time, well, the ACLU certainly has been willing to represent unpopular causes right up to the present day. So for example, in Florida in 2009, the Dove World Outreach Center wanted their students to wear these shirts to school that said Islam is of the devil. That was upsetting to a number of the Muslim students who were in that school, but the ACLU in Florida, the Florida chapter, represented the parents to allow these hateful shirts to be worn to school. In 2007, the Westboro Baptist Church, which is actually in Topeka, Kansas, was represented by the Eastern Missouri chapter of the ACLU. The Westboro Baptist Church, probably many of you know, believe that homosexuality is a sin, that Americans are being punished for allowing that sin by having soldiers die in wars. In this particular case, it was soldiers who had died from Iraq. So they would protest these, holding signs like that. And probably most famously, the ACLU represented a neo-Nazi group that wanted to march down the streets of Skokie, Illinois in 1977. Skokie was the center of the Jewish community in the Chicago area, and in 1977 included many Holocaust survivors, yet they were willing to represent this as an issue of free speech, causing later the Humor Online magazine, Onion, to have a headline once that said, ACLU defends neo-Nazis' right to burn down ACLU headquarters. But on March 2nd, 1991, this headline appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer. "There is certainly a free exercise of religion claim by the parents," said Deborah Levy of the Philadelphia chapter of the ACLU. "But there is also a competing claim that parents don't have the right to martyr their children," she says, basically echoing that 1945 Sarah Prince versus Massachusetts ruling. "I don't think we've walked away from our principles here." So on March 2nd, 1991, the judge permits the city to vaccinate objectors. Now, Jerome Balter was a lawyer for the parents of the Faith Tabernacle Church, and he protested Summer's decision, quote, "Their healing is dependent on their faith," he says. "They believe that's the right thing to do for their children. But the judge rules in favor of the city, and so Balter takes his case to the Pennsylvania Superior Court of Appeals. Now, the state superior court judge at the time was Vincent Cirillo. During the appeal, Sean Lacey, who was actually representing the children, Balter was representing the parents, she was handed a note and looked ill when she received that note. And so Cirillo asked during the hearing, "Are you ill?" Lacey had just been handed a note concerning a 20-month-old boy named James Jones, whose parents are members of Faith Tabernacle, who had measles encephalitis and who died from the disease, actually in our hospital. So I remember that case. Balter now argues that parents are willing to allow sick children to be admitted to the hospital, but still refuses to have them vaccinated, implying that treatment is as good as prevention, a statement that clearly is contradicted by events of the previous month. But on March 9, 1991, this headline appears in the Philadelphia Daily News as, to my knowledge, for the first time in history, children were vaccinated against their parents' will. And on June 7, 1991, the measles epidemic slows. This is invariably true come summer months. "Typically, measles is a disease of the late winter and early spring," says Robert Levinson, director of disease control. "When the warm weather comes, the cases disappear." Charles Reinert, who's the pastor of Faith Tabernacle, has a different interpretation, focusing on the children in his church who'd survived the infection without medical care. He said, "We believe God has provided his faithfulness." On December 3rd, 1992, Bill Atkinson and his group published that paper in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, "As the Dust Settled, Looking Back on Our Outbreak." Among church members, 486 people were infected and 6 killed. Among non-church members, 938 people were infected and 3 killed. We had more than 1,400 cases of measles in our city during that few-month period and 9 deaths. All deaths were in children. The attack rate in church members was about 1,000-fold greater than that in the surrounding community. In 2013, the CDC has identified about 30,000 children whose parents have chosen not to vaccinate them for religious reasons. Given the underreporting and the insular nature of some faith healing groups, that number is probably much higher. Okay, so I was up at 3:30 this morning, and this next slide was one I created this morning, and I know I'm going to regret this slide, but I'm going to do it anyway. The quote that was commonly given by parents of these children was, "Jesus was my doctor." And I'm not a religious person, but I'm working on a book about that's about the clash between modern medicine and religious belief. It'll be coming out early next year. And in the writing of that book, I have actually read a lot of the New Testament and the Old Testament, and I don't get it. I don't get how this is the conclusion. It's independent of whether you believe this is, you should never talk, just a tip for those of you who are ever thinking of speaking in public, never talk about religion, never. You'll never win talking about religion, but I'm going to do it anyway. Independent of whether you believe that there is a God, independent of whether or not you believe that Jesus was the Son of God, or independent of whether or not one buys the Gospels, which were written 50 to 200 years after Jesus' death, as an historical document, the fact of the matter is that what is written in those Gospels as attributed to Jesus sets him apart from his time. I mean, he was a, at least as described in the Gospels, is a breakthrough figure. I mean, at the time of his birth, infanticide was common. Abandonment was common. Children were property. I mean, children didn't matter. If you look at Hippocrates' writings, which were 400 years before the birth of Jesus, he never mentions children. I mean, he talks about how one should interact with the patients, but children are never mentioned because children didn't matter. They were an unimportant object. That was true at the time of Jesus' birth, but that is not what is attributed to him. What's attributed to him is that he stands up for children. I mean, he, throughout the New Testament, there's story after story about his standing up for children. He believed children were human, therefore children had a right to heaven. Suffer me the children, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs, right? Matthew 19:14. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Or my favorite line, actually, also in Matthew, is, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it to one of the least of my brethren, you have done it unto me. I mean, you could put that on the entranceway of every children's hospital in the world. Because of his ministry, Constantine, who was the first Christian emperor of Rome, put forth edicts in 315 and 321 AD that were the first to protect children. I mean, to protect children from abuses like infanticide and abandonment, which were not illegal. He made them illegal. He also put in place sort of relief societies for children who were abandoned that really set the stage for relief societies that existed for the next 1,800 years. I mean, early monasteries contained, you know, I'm talking about the sort of 2nd century AD, 3rd century AD, had inpatient and outpatient facilities that were prototypes for the modern-day hospital. Missionaries like Albert Schweitzer in Africa or Edward Bliss in China brought modern medicine to the four corners of the earth in Jesus' name. I don't understand how one can reasonably conclude that it's okay to leave my child vulnerable to disease, or worse, not to treat them when they have a disease in the name of Jesus. And what bothered me at the time of this outbreak was, where were the religious leaders in our city standing up for the children? I mean, where were they to stand up? And I'm thinking specifically of Anthony Bevilacqua, who was at the time an archbishop and now and then became a cardinal, actually that year in 1991, to stand up and say, this isn't us. This isn't us. This is not religion. And what bothers me in all this is when religion is used to cross a line to act inhumanely, then it's not religion anymore, and it shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion. See, told you I should have never written that thing this morning. But so I'll leave you with this: why do we allow such a profoundly unreligious act to be performed in the name of religion? I'll give you another example, just one small one. I don't know if you have to deal with this in L.A., but we certainly deal with this in Philadelphia and anywhere, and frankly, throughout the Northeast, is the Mitzitza B'Peh ritual. Is this something that you have to deal with, which is herpes in the newborn? Okay, for those of you who don't know about this, there are certain ultra-Orthodox Jewish sects which believe that the circumcision ritual is to be performed in accord with the 5th century Babylonian Talmud, that when you, after you cut the foreskin, that you then remove the blood that's there with your mouth. This is done. Actually, it's fairly common in New York City, Lakewood, New Jersey, which admits to our hospital. So we just a couple weeks ago had one of these cases where the child had had herpes simplex virus lesions around the glands of the penis, which then spread to the diaper area, and also there was mild hepatitis, and in this particular case, and pneumonitis, as one sees in these babies. So there have been a few deaths in the last couple years secondary to this procedure called Mitzitza B'Peh, which literally means sucking with the mouth. What I sort of like about this is that there's a number of Jewish scholars who and rabbis who have stepped forward here and said, this is not us, that this is primitive nonsense, that there's no safe way to clean an open wound with your mouth. And I like that. I mean, I like that at least the people are willing to say this isn't us. There was actually a rabbi in Philadelphia who recently is an anti-vaccine person, as it turns out. They're everywhere. He stood up and he said that he thought that the polio vaccine was a hoax, and that so there was another a guy named Moshe Tendler who stood up and said he is not speaking as a rabbi. He's speaking as an uninformed layperson, and I like that. But that was absent in our city, and I'm telling you, at the time in our city, you were just looking for some help. How about a little help here? And we didn't get it. Okay, in any case, I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention.